Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It's my pleasure to turn the page and turn our attention to Iyawa's testimony. It's one of the things that we learn when we study the malfeasance being perpetrated, the deceit and delusions, the hypocrisy being postured by religions and in politics by all manner of individuals in today's society, most of them without any care for what they're doing, or the fact that it's disadvantageous to the American people. You've got guys like James Clapper and the president and Dianne Feinstein all touting their willingness to violate the rule of law, becoming criminals themselves, to spy on others, and says, oh, it's a really good thing that we're doing it. And I think you even find the majority of American people are saying, oh, yeah, no problem, I don't care that my constitution is being ignored. Well, you know what does care? His constitution is called the Torah. It is the most liberating document ever written, most insightful document ever written, most brilliant document ever written. The Torah exists to introduce us to Yahweh, tells us who he is, tells us what he did, which is creating the universe and conceiving life. It presents that plan in a very systematic, scientific way that is completely consistent with what we have learned to be true, right down to the timing and sequence of the events. And God then transitions from his creation of the universe to his desire to form a relationship with man, talks about specifically the kind of interactions he had with Adam in the Gan Eden, the Garden of Great Joy. Speaks then of the fact that he allowed free will, that he allowed choice, that he allowed Hasatan, the adversary, to slither into the garden, specifically to corrupt his testimony, so that that choice to embrace God's instructions or to reject them was genuine, viable, so that there was a viable, credible, although beguiling and disingenuous, alternative. And what we see when we review that is that for those that say, I can't believe God would allow someone to corrupt his word, and therefore they hold up their Bible as if the inerrant word of God, not even recognizing that most of what's written in their Bible contradicts what God actually said, everything Paul wrote, for example, and that there is no commonality between any of the earlier manuscripts, which means that the claim that it is inerrant is absolutely ridiculous, because there are more discrepancies than there are words in the so-called Christian New Testament when you look at the oldest manuscripts and compare them to what is presented today. But God did allow that because choice requires it. Free will requires it. And we see as the model that Satan used in the creation of every religion, which is rather than creating out of whole cloth a alternative to God, and therefore present himself as a unique individual equally worthy of worship, devotion, if you will. What Hasatan does universally is he usurps Yahweh's credibility. He starts with what God says because it's credible. And then he takes it out of context, twists it a bit, adds to it, like the Christian New Testament, like Muhammad's Quran. And the adding to it and the criticism of it and the poor, inaccurate citations from it presents something that isn't very creative. In fact, it's no more creative than a counterfeit. But as a counterfeit, even though many of the strokes look somewhat similar, it is wholly worthless. That's the way he operates. That's the way the Christian religion became so popular. That is how Judaism became popular. It's how Islam became popular. It's usurping God's credibility, just like the adversary did when he was allowed to slither into the garden, misquoting God, taking him out of context, claiming God's credibility, and then leading people in a different direction, away from him, and as it turns out, towards Satan. And then we find God telling us that man with a nesama, that man when he's given the opportunity to be discerning and discriminating, very often becomes rotten to the core. And so the kind of behaviors that we are witnessing today, as Glenn spoke of a modern Sodom and Gomorrah, and the fact, as Jason said, that our political institutions are the living embodiment of this kind of corruption today and hypocrisy. God spoke of this way back at the time of Noah and said that that humanity had become rotten, particularly those humans with the Nesama, the gift that he gave us so that we could exercise good judgment. Because much of the time it is surrendered, man becomes a cunning creature as opposed to a moral creature with this capacity. And so the flood was designed to rid the world of all but eight people with a Nesama. We then go directly to the ultimate story of the Torah. That is the covenant. And God reaching out to Abraham and encouraging Abraham to leave his country, which was Babylon, which God speaks of at great extent, talks about Babylon, which Babel, meaning corruption. And he assails, and particularly in Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, Isaiah and Jeremiah, the religious and political, military and economic construct that became Babylon. And first thing God says, if you're going to form a relationship with me, and that's what I'm offering you here. And I'm God, by the way. My name is Yahweh. Pleasure to meet you. I'm offering you the opportunity to have a relationship with me. I'm going to give you, there's going to be five terms and conditions. There'll be five benefits of this relationship. But the first condition is that you have to walk away from patriotism, from politics, from religion, from militarism, from all of the stuff that we've been talking about that is so corrupt that collectively humankind is engaged in. And then God says, instead of trusting and relying upon them, as so many people around the world have been conditioned and hoodwinked into doing, he says, trust and rely on me, which means you've got to get to know him. You've got to have shared experiences with him. You have to know who he is and what he is offering to be able to trust and rely upon him. And then God says, walk to me and become perfect. And God himself created the means to accomplish that. The doorway for this walk is called Passover. The threshold for perfection, once we have eternal life, is called matzah. They are coterminous. One without the other would be counterproductive. This leads to the ability of God to adopt us into his covenant family on Bukodim. And the next step along that journey, the first four of which have already been fulfilled in the fourth millennia of humankind because they provide the benefits of the covenant, is that God enriches us and he empowers us through the promise of sevens, which is Shavua. That's the story. The story of God creating the universe for express purpose, the covenant. An eternal covenant. An unchanging covenant. Now, that's not to say that the covenant will remain forever unchanged. There will be a change made to the covenant. It has not been made yet. It will be in the not-too-distant future. As a matter of fact, we're only 20 years away from this change. In Yirmiyahu 31, Yahweh says that he is going to renew, reaffirm his covenant with Yehudim and with Yisrael, not with Goyim. The means for Goyim, like myself, to form a relationship with Yahweh has long been established. We do it individually. But God made promises collectively to Yisrael and to Yehudim. He wants them reconciled not only to one another, but also to him. And so the reaffirmation of the covenant is not with the Christian church, it's with Yehudim and with Yisrael. In today's parlance, it would be Israel and Jews. And he says to them that this reconciliation, this reaffirmation of my covenant isn't going to be exactly the same as it previously was. And so that if you just read that, if you don't read who it's with and you just read that, you say, oh, well, then there's going to be a new Testament, a new covenant. And that's Paul's deal, man. He's talking about how everything's changed. He's got a new one. It's not that old one anymore. But then you have to realize, wait a minute, this is with Yehudim and with Yisrael, the very people that Paul excluded from his mission. The very people who are the enemy of, and for many years, of Christianity, particularly Roman Catholicism. And then you have to think for a moment, wait a minute, are Yehudim and Yisrael reconciled to God, or are they still in a hostile rabbinical religion? Well, they aren't reconciled yet, are they? And so you have to look at this and say, well, what are the differences? I mean, are the differences what Christianity claims, that faith in the gospel of grace is going to replace that dastardly, ineffective, and oppressive law? Is that what we are to believe? I mean, that's what Christianity is based on. They claim their justification from Jeremiah 31, and that's their conclusion. But what does God say is going to be the difference? Does he say that I'm going to obsolete the Torah and that I'm going to bring in based upon the pagan cuties, the goddesses of licentiousness and the charities, the cherish and the gratia, the graces of Rome and Greece? Is that what I'm going to do? Is that what he says? I'm going to create a gospel and I'm going to replace knowing with faith? I'm going to change everything? Is that what he said he's going to do? Or does the Christian church do the same thing that Satan does, which is to misquote God and remove what he said in context so that he can add an entirely different spin on it, one that suits their agenda? What does Yirmiyahu 31 say in this regard? He says, yeah, I'm going to have a different one. How is it different? He tells us. The difference is that he's going to write his Torah inside of us. That's how it's different. That means the wholesale integration of the Torah, God's teaching, into our lives. That's how it's different. Now, I don't know about you, but I have to go to the document and to read the Torah. I'm not capable of looking inside of me and finding a perfect copy of the Torah placed inside of me by God. I have to go to the document and read it. I'm looking forward to the day that it's inside of me, incorporated into my life. But what is the difference between the Torah being a document I can choose to observe and the document literally being incorporated into my life? And when you understand the answer to that question, you'll understand where we are in the sequence of godly events. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're telling the story of life, the story of our genesis, the story of God's purpose for creating the universe, and ultimately telling the story of how our eternity is going to be, at least for the select few who have chosen to accept and embrace Yahweh's terms and conditions relative to participating in this relationship. So I asked a question, you know, why is it that this covenant is going to change? He says specifically it is different. And as I've shared, he tells us what the difference is, which is that he writes his Torah inside of us, literally making it an integral part of our character and lives. And Torah means guidance, teaching, instructions, directions. So he writes his instructions, his teachings, his guidance inside of us, making it part of our lives. Why is that going to happen in 20 years upon his return in 2033? And why has it not happened previously? Can you imagine how much better the world would be if everyone had incorporated into their internal nature a perfect copy of the Torah, so that it couldn't be misconstrued, corrupted, couldn't be ignored? You couldn't create a religion of Christianity, because almost everything Christianity promotes is the antithesis of what's written in the Torah. You couldn't have any religion, as a matter of fact. They'd all be annulled. So why is it that God is going to be able to do that then and hasn't done it now? Scott?
Because we still have time to choose.
Choice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Could Satan have hoodwinked Chawa and Adam in the garden and taking something God said out of context and encouraging Chawa to run off and add to it and alter it? Could that have been done if Yahweh's directions were incorporated into her very nature?
No. No.
Could Paul have pulled off the hoax that he did of saying that the Torah has been annulled, that it never had the power to save, that it was a archaic and corrupt document that was for a bygone era? Could he have done that if the Torah's liberation testimony was incorporated into the souls, the hearts and minds of his audience?
No, nor do you want to.
Could Muhammad claim that his, credibly claim that his Quran confirms the Torah if the actual Torah was inscribed in the hearts, souls, and minds of the Arabs he was communicating that to?
No, not at all.
No. Could the secular humanists present the Torah effectively as being mean-spirited and a hostile document that is an outdated document for a bygone era that presents religious myths? If the Torah was incorporated into those they were trying to tell that story to?
No, they couldn't.
No. Would it be possible for me to misquote God, to lead people away from God, if the people I was talking to actually had a copy of the Torah written inside of them?
No.
How do you reject the Torah if it's as much a part of you as your own heart? Could I reject my own heart and survive it?
No.
So if God writes his Torah on our hearts, then is there any way that I could reject him or it without dying in the process?
Nope.
So what would be the purpose of free will?
To give you the choice to make that choice.
Well, that is the purpose of it. But would free will have any value if the choice of whether or not to embrace the Torah or not was already made for you?
Yeah. Well, no. You wouldn't even know what free will is.
You're right. And so the only way that God can create a family of people who choose to be with him, who choose to get to know him, who choose to respect him, who choose to love him, who choose to understand what he's offering, who choose to invest time in the relationship, who choose to act upon the conditions of his relationship, who choose the benefits of that relationship, the only way for him to do that is to make it a choice. If it's already chosen for us, it isn't a choice, is it?
No, it wouldn't be. We'd be malak.
Right. Now, going forward, once all choices have been made, when Yahusha is returning, now, that means that all choices of the mortals who have been born up to that point, they've made their choices. And so, is God therefore able, to all of those who chose to be with him, to uphold the Torah, to observe the Torah, to accept the Torah's instructions, would it now be appropriate for him to integrate the Torah into their lives?
Yeah. Well, once you made your choice, you won't mind when it gets written on your heart.
In fact, you'll love it. And we'll be back to Shattering Myths in a moment. Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. You can participate in this discussion, 877-300-7645. One of the things that is really interesting is that we move to year 6000 Yah, which is 2033 on our pagan calendars. Yah was going to return for the seventh and final time to planet Earth as the sun sets in Jerusalem on what we would call October 2nd of 2033. It's Yom Kippurim. And year 6000 Yah on God's calendar, 5 days later, the Earth will be returned to the conditions enjoyed in the Garden of Eden. Now, one of the things that will be unique about our lives, there's really twofold. For 1,000 years, there's going to be a millennial celebration of the Sabbath. And the existing Torah will be the constitution of the millennial Shabbat. And therefore, those who are administrators, those who are working on behalf of Yahweh, which I think are going to primarily be Yehudim and Yisrael that are going to be the administrators of the millennial Shabbat. They're going to return to the Torah's directions, which are to adjudicate disputes based upon the Torah. So having a perfect copy of the Torah integrated into the individuals who are acting as administrators of during this time is absolutely essential. As for those who are born during this period, God didn't say that each of them is going to be born with the Torah inside of them. As a matter of fact, there will be free will. They will have the opportunity to accept or reject Yah's guidance during the millennial Shabbat. And there are consequences for doing so. Even God says that at the end of this millennial Shabbat, he's going to allow the same thing that he did in the Garden of Eden. Because, after all, the millennial Shabbat is a thousand-year celebration of the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden, which means at the end of it, Satan has to be let back in, and he will once again offer a genuine option to those who wish to reject God. Now, for those of us, though, who are not the administrators of the millennial Shabbat, and personally, I'm hoping that Goyim are excluded from that role, and I don't have any concrete evidence that we will be, because once we're adopted into God's family, there is no distinction between us. But nonetheless, my hope is that just as during the 7 years between the, at least 7 years, I think, between the harvest of the children of the covenant on Teruah, and the conclusion of the tribulation in 2033, where we'll be off exploring the universe, because God specifically says that as he returns, we're going to be summoned for the four corners of the universe so that we can join him upon his return. That during those 7 years, and which will seem like an eternity or seem like a nanosecond, depending on our perspective, because we will become energy-based and therefore time, in terms of the ordinary flow of it, becomes irrelevant. But from that point and throughout eternity, as we become a energy-based entity, we shed the limitations of our physical body, which requires us to be stuck in time, where you can only move at a certain speed, and therefore it puts off limits almost the whole of the universe. But as an energy-based entity, we can explore the furthest reaches of the universe and be from one place to another in no time at all. And we, because of the nature of energy, can explore the interworkings of molecules, if we wish, on the nanoscale, or we can observe the formation of galaxies on the universal scale. You got to imagine, since there's some really explosive things going on out there, like black holes, which you don't want to be sucked into, that there's going to need to be some guidance given to us, some instructions on how to operate in this enormously fascinating universe in such a way that we don't goof things up or get ourselves into trouble. I mean, I know I am not capable of operating as light with my present knowledge. So I'm quite thrilled about the idea that as we move from the limitations of our physical bodies to being a spiritual entity in God's family and exploring the universe, that we're going to have his instructions. Now, I'm going to be so bold, and I've said this before, but bear with me on this thought. While those living in the and administrating the millennial Shabbat for that 1,000 years here on earth have to have a copy of the existing Torah in them, because the existing Torah not only introduces us to Yahweh, but explains the means that we deploy to engage in the covenant relationship with him and thus be saved. And so it is the essential blueprint, and it isn't going to change. And during the millennial Shabbat, there's going to be the temple and all of the celebrations of Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim are going to transpire as they are described in the Torah. Has to be that way for people to be able to choose to participate in the covenant the way that we have. But once you've made that choice and you're off now exploring the universe, 99% of what's in the Torah is no longer relevant. We've already made the choice. As a matter of fact, some of it's even counterproductive because, like a loving father, in the Torah, there's always God shares the consequence of choosing to ignore him, choosing to go in a different direction. And he delineates the harm that is the consequence of doing the wrong thing. But that would bring sorrow and pain to us living in eternity, and there is no sorrow and pain in eternity. So that's information that would be counterproductive. We've already made the choice. We don't need to know of the consequence and the pain associated with making the wrong choice. And so most of what's written in the Torah is no longer relevant going forward as members of God's family and exploring the universe, particularly as he creates a new universe with us as witnesses. So it's an entirely different set of guidelines and instructions. Now, different doesn't mean that nothing's going to contradict what God has already said, but these have to be supplemental directions that tell us how to behave in such a way that we can still express our free will. I want to go visit a black hole, but to go witness the event without getting incarcerated in it. And that's the kind of thing that God is suggesting by the timing and the word Torah and the reaffirmation of his covenant upon his return. All of that explains where we are in this process. It explains the nature of the process, the nature of the choice that we are given. It explains where we go to find the choice and how that choice manifests itself in terms of future consequence. It's one of the most marvelous aspects of God's complete story. Now, what this means also is that you'd have to be either ignorant or irrational to conclude, as Christians must, based upon Paul's letters, that God came to realize that the Torah was inept, that the Torah was counterproductive, that the Torah couldn't save anyone, and therefore he turned over responsibility to Paul to create a new approach, a different approach, that annuls his old approach, and that approach is called faith in the gospel of grace, only to, upon his return, go back to the old approach and integrate the Torah into our lives. I mean, the very presentation of the one thing that Christians can hold their hat on out of context and twisted and errantly translated to say, see, there's justification for our new covenant right here, our new testament right here, our new way of doing things right here. When you read the whole thing, completely precludes that from being the case. It would be utterly irrational for God to say, yep, my old system was failed. It was counterproductive. It was archaic. It needs to be discarded, and it needs to be replaced by this thing that Paul will conceive that becomes the basis of the Christian religion. And then when I return, I'm going to go back to my old way. It's absurd. Which means that there can be no Christian New Testament. Which means that faith in the gospel of grace is an overt lie. It's irrational, ignorant. There's nothing godly about it. The very passage that Christians turn to justify their religion destroys it. That's why I've said for so many years, it is impossible to be an informed and rational Christian. If you're informed, if you know these things, you're not going to be a Christian. At least the only way you can be informed and remain a Christian is to be irrational. One of the most important aspects of the Torah happens to be the presentation of the Ten Statements. There are no commandments. These are not commandments. They are statements and instructions. Seven instructions, three overriding, sweeping statements. They're introduced with this. And God conveyed all of these statements providing perspective in our presence, saying, what's the first thing that he said? I am Yahweh. So, when you have the Torah written inside of you, what are you going to call God? He said, I am Yahweh. Do you think you're going to be able to call him Jesus Christ? Do you think you'll be able to call him the Lord? What did he say? First thing he wrote, I am Yahweh. If you don't know him as Yahweh, you don't know God. I am Yahweh, your Almighty, your God, who relationally and beneficially, from the Hebrew word Asher, brought you out and delivered you. I descended to serve you from the realm of the crucible of Egypt, Mitzrayim, the plural of crucible. What are the crucibles that he saved us from? Divine judgment and human oppression, religious and political oppression specifically. I delivered you away from the house of slavery. How in the world then does Paul's letters that speak of the Torah enslaving integrate into that statement? Or are they wholly opposed to it? You shall not exist with other gods in proximity to my presence. We'll return in a moment. Just think of the power in this statement, the clarity in this statement. It's one of the things that irks me so much when Christians say, well, that's your interpretation. How do you misinterpret this? And God conveyed all of these statements, all of these words, providing perspective in our presence, saying, I am Yahweh, your God, who relationally and beneficially brought you out and delivered you from the realm of the crucible of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall not exist with other gods in proximity to my presence. Now, how, if people just knew that, how could there be a religion of Islam? Allah is a different God. Allah is not Yahweh. When the Quran says repeatedly that it confirms the Torah and yet contradicts it on this essential point, the first point that God etched in stone, anybody that was the least bit rational, the least bit informed, would know that the religion of Islam is a complete and utter fraud, and therefore it should be exposed and condemned. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? When the religion of Christianity decided to rename Yahusha, which is means Yahweh saves, so that he could be disassociated from Yahweh and become a very different God for their different religion, the moment that was done, it was in direct violation of the first statement that Yah etched in stone. So how does the religion of Christianity claim that it's based upon and includes the testimony of Yahweh, and yet by the very nature of the name of the religion, Christianity, based upon Christ, which was based upon Christos, which means the application of drugs, how is that related to Yahweh? It isn't. It's another God. So it's a God that man has conceived. In fact, a God created in the image of man. It's a God that's born, a God that dies. How does, by the way, dear Christian, man kill God? Why would you place your faith in a God that man can kill? Christian? It's an amazingly powerful statement. The simple opening declaration undermines every religion, from Hinduism, many gods, to Buddhism, no god, to Judaism, animosity to God's name, to Christianity, wrongly named God, from Islam, where Satan becomes God, to Mormonism, fable about gods, and Jehovah's Witnesses, wrong name for God. It undermines the Christian scientists, the Scientologists, and the socialist secular humanists, where man denies God. They're all impugned by Yahweh's opening statement, his introduction. God has but one name, and Yahweh alone is God. The countless corrupted and errant variations of Him created by man on behalf of their religious schemes are not to be tolerated, including Krishna, Shiva, Vishnu, Buddha. Curiously, a Hindu god, but not a Buddhist deity. Hashem, Jesus, Christ, Allah, and Jehovah. Yahweh introduced himself by name. He told us that he is our Savior. He told us that he is our Liberator. He told us that he is our source of continued existence. All of those things are conveyed in that opening statement. Yahweh has encouraged us to develop a monogamous personal relationship with him on a first-name basis. Then, because he is spirit, Yahweh asks us to avoid all associations with false gods by way of their religious imagery. And as we shall soon see, he even asks us not to worship them, bowing down in a religious setting. But more than this, Yahweh has emphatically stated that his dabar, his word, lies at the heart of his relational dabar conversation with humankind. That is why dabar was repeated twice in the opening stanza. First is a verb, actionable, and then is a noun, definable. By doing so, his promise is that his word will provide the means to our liberation from judgment and oppression. More fully amplified and illuminated by way of the Hebrew words, Yahweh himself wrote, "We are afforded the opportunity to learn even more about Yahweh's nature and purpose." He wrote, "And, wa." That is the based upon the middle letter in his means to increase, to add to. Elohim, the Almighty, conveyed, dabar, communicated. All of these words, dabar, now, as a noun, providing perspective, Ilah, from our vantage point in presence, saying, "I am Yahweh." We'll return to Shattering Myths this time tomorrow. May Yah bless you all.